This podcast episode was generously funded by two anonymous donors. If you would like to support the podcast in similar ways, please contact Hadley Kelly at hkelly@pbk.org. Thanks for listening. Hello and welcome to Key Conversations with Phi Beta Kappa. I'm Fred Lawrence, Secretary and CEO of the Phi Beta Kappa Society. Since 2018, we have welcomed leading thinkers, visionaries, and artists to our podcast. These individuals have shaped our collective understanding of some of today's most pressing and consequential matters, in addition to sharing stories with us about their scholarly and personal journeys. Many of our guests are Phi Beta Kappa visiting scholars who travel the country to our Phi Beta Kappa chapters, where they spend 2 days on campus and present free public lectures. We invite you to attend. For more information about visiting scholars' lectures, please visit pbk.org. Today, I'm delighted to welcome Professor Talitha Washington. Dr. Washington is the inaugural director of the Atlanta University Center Data Science Initiative. She is professor of mathematics at Clark Atlanta University and an affiliate faculty at Morehouse College, Morehouse School of Medicine, and Spelman College. Dr. Washington is also the director and lead principal investigator of the NSF-funded National Data Science Alliance and president of the Association for Women in Mathematics, the AWM. She works across HBCUs to expand data science research that advocates for social justice. She is a fellow of the AWM, the American Mathematical Society, and the AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Welcome, Professor.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Our students often look at the paths of our careers and they assume it's a straight line, but we know that there are many twists and turns along the way. And I'm going to guess that becoming a PhD mathematician and a principal investigator on a National Science Foundation data science project was not exactly predictable to a young girl growing up in the 70s and 80s in Evansville, Indiana. Have I got that right?
You have definitely got that right, because I don't think that was on my mind at all. I hail from the great state of Indiana, and a lot of people there are engineers. So when I went to college, I majored in engineering. I didn't want to go to school for 5 years because they had an engineering program where you go there for 3 years and 2 additional years. So I thought 5 years of school was just way too much. And then I didn't want to do any of the labs because I'm super clumsy. And so I just whittled it down to something that was engineering related and chose the easier major, which is mathematics. And so that's how I fell into mathematics. And it's been a journey ever since.
Let's start back even further. Tell us a little bit about growing up in Evansville, Indiana in the 1970s and 80s.
Well, Evansville, Indiana, it's a southwestern town. It's right there on the Ohio River, a border town. I grew up in the center city of Evansville, which is a tight-knit community, African-American community. And when I was growing up, we understood race and racism in the town. In the early 1900s, David Curtis Stevenson came up from Texas to Evansville to restart the Ku Klux Klan. And so growing up, if you go to certain parts of town, it would not be a positive experience. And I remember even when my older brother played on the Boise basketball team and they went to a town to go play, and alongside on the road was a cross burning. So even though we had that close-knit community, it was very protective, which I thought was great. And I still go back home and I have tons of moms and dads and all the rest of that. But we also were cognizant of the society that we lived in that really wasn't welcoming of everyone.
You know, the parents in that neighborhood were kind of parents for the entire neighborhood, not just for their own children.
Oh, yeah. So if you were out doing something that you weren't supposed to be doing, your mom or dad would get a call. And before you even step over, you're stepping over the threshold of the house. And they say, well, I heard A, B, and C. You're like, whoa. How did that happen?
Right. My rule with my parents was that if they heard about it from me first, I had half a chance. But if they heard about it from somebody else, I was in serious trouble.
Usually for me, it was the latter.
Now, among the things that you and I have in common is that we both took AP chemistry in high school, but neither of us went into chemistry. What possessed you to take AP chemistry, which means as a senior in high school, you're essentially taking a college level chemistry class?
Yeah, I liked AP chemistry with Mr. Sanders. He was so great. He would just map out chemistry in a way that just made sense. And my favorite part in hindsight really was the stoichiometry, where you use mathematics to kind of wrangle through all the different chemical units and converting and things, how things, see how things are related and how one thing can lead to the next. And Mr. Sanders at Bossy High School just really enjoyed the teaching of chemistry and just brought us along with it. It was super fun. And I remember being in the lab going, Mr. Sanders, my hands are burning because I'm so clumsy. And so I would always accidentally do something. He's okay, Talitha. And he's very calm and patient with us and really just kind of helped us along the way. And little did I know, fast forward, I guess it was a couple decades later, he became a colleague of mine at the University of Evansville. We never know, from our high school chemistry teacher to a colleague at a university setting. And he was still super great just to sit down and talk with.
So in some ways, the pure intellectual joy of solving the mathematical problems of chemistry is what appealed to you most about the study of chemistry.
Exactly.
And from high school, you move on to Spelman College in Atlanta, preeminent historically Black college or university, HBCU. And I think it's fair to say the single most highly recognized women's HBCU. What was that like growing up in Center City, Evansville, to now be on the campus of the great Spelman College?
I had a little tour in between. So I actually graduated high school semester early and went on exchange to Costa Rica as a foreign exchange student. And I stayed in the small town of Juan Vinas, didn't really know any Spanish other than si, no, banana, and taco, and learned it by brute force. And I think that's really where I learned this transition of really being out of the element, having to read social cues that I didn't really understand, having just to absorb and soak up a language at an exponential rate just to keep up. And it was a great experience. So I remember when I first went to Spelman, I was like, why are you all having so much trouble with this transition? I was like, oh, I did that when I went to Costa Rica. Mm-hmm. I learned how to transition. I learned how to navigate in new, for lack of a better word, foreign circles and just thrive it and have a good time with it. But when I got to Spelman, all African-American female women's undergraduate college, and it was a great experience to be able to just go in and learn about Black women in STEM and history and have all of these role models right there in the classroom who really said, I've been there, I've done that, and you can and you will do it too. So it was just a really wonderful learning experience.
You've also described elsewhere the experience that many HBCU students of having the opportunity, the privilege, if you will, of being able to study and doubt and express uncertainty, all of it completely free from having to be the Black student, having to represent what it means to be the Black student in the class.
Right. That's a huge weight. Most of our students that come in the classroom, they want to learn something. And or they're just intrigued, or you can ignite that intrigue or that curiosity. But when you have that curiosity, that intrigue, and if it's overburdened by being the spokesperson for an entire race, or having to justify why you're there, or having to defend your knowledge because a person who looks a certain way is not expected to possess knowledge in a certain way, that can be overtaxing and crushing to many students and professionals as well. And so being able to be in an environment where you just take all of that away, you can just be that student, you can learn, you're the expectation, you're not the exception. It's a freeing that it's hard to describe unless one has been there.
So if somebody had pulled you aside and whispered, so this is where it's going to take you. You're going to be a PhD mathematician. You're going to wind up with a major center here. Would you have said, no, that couldn't happen? Or were you said, yeah, that actually starts to sound like the kind of thing that would interest me?
Well, when we first got to Spelman, we have a freshwoman week, and we were told, welcome to Spelman. Now, after you're done here, which graduate degree are you going to get?
Wow.
And the motto of Spelman is a choice to change the world. So it's not positioning for self, it's positioning to really make a positive impact on the world. So if somebody said you would get a PhD, I was told that, okay, sure, why not?
Right.
I started in pre-calculus too in college. I was not a student who was chartered for that high-level, intense, yes, you're going to be successful in mathematics. I just kind of started pre-calc too and just worked my way up my second semester. I took a proofwriting class. I didn't know what was going on. So instead of failing it, I dropped it. But I remember my friend saying, hey, why don't you just stick with the math? It's okay. Just stay with it. So I took that class a year later, made an A, and stuck with the math and just kept going. I always say I'm a late bloomer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even though I might have started the pre-calc too, I ended up with a strong background. Even with Phi Beta Kappa, I became Phi Beta Kappa in 2017. So it's never too late. Stay the course, stay persistent.
And it gets hard for all of us at some point or another. And in some ways, I think ironically or otherwise, the people for whom it seems to be harder sooner, so to get a handle on what perseverance means, there are other people for whom things come more easily for a long time. And when they finally hit a real challenge, they don't have the tools to deal constructively with that challenge.
Yeah, very well said. Yeah, so I built a lot of tools along the way.
And then you leave the confines of an HBCU and you're on the campus of University of Connecticut, where it turns out, if I have this right, you are going to become the first Black woman to get a PhD in mathematics. Is that right?
Yep, in the year 2001.
Between Spelman and University of Connecticut, you were blessed with mentors who worked with you, advanced your work along two very important institutions in your life. One of your visiting scholar lectures is called Choosing to Become a Mathematician in Spite of the Obstacles. So tell us a little bit about what that talk is about, but what are the obstacles?
Math can be hard, not impossible, but mathematics in itself can be hard. And then also sometimes we put obstacles in our way by choosing or not choosing to do things. It also could be that maybe we just didn't put the time on the task, or maybe we weren't looped in with the proper network to propagate forward. Or maybe, as in my case, in graduate school, you start having babies. And not saying that babies are an obstacle, they're a blessing. But at that time, I didn't have a maternity leave. So I always say, you know, three kids later, can I cash in my maternity leave now? So I literally gave birth and then started working like a few weeks later. I mean, I made it through, and it was in spite of any perceived obstacles. But sometimes life can just be hard, whether we make decisions or just propagating through, learning new things, and just staying the course.
Staying the course, perseverance, is that a lot of what that talk is about, that visiting scholar lecture?
Yeah. And then oftentimes in mathematics, being an African-American female in mathematics, oftentimes there is a perception that mathematics is done by a certain demographic group, not by African-Americans. And so negotiating somebody's low expectation or somebody's either micro or macro aggression, and being able to, I'll say, work around that and still be successful can be challenging and difficult. And in some cases can be really wearing as far as advancing in the field. The field of mathematics is very peer driven. We review each other's papers and determine and give suggestions for it to be accepted or not. We do the same thing with grants. We do the same thing with tenure track professors. We get reviewed by other people who look and say whether or not we're going to make a contribution. And many of that, while we do have people's track record and information, much of that can be subjective, because if one doesn't get into the right research group, that could really prevent the career from going forward. And so I I've had friends as well who've really had a challenging time at different points in their career, just because the micro, the macro aggressions, racism, or what have you, intrudes on people's discernment of who can contribute to science and who should contribute to science. And hopefully, with the work that I'm doing, that helps to change that narrative so that we can all bring our talents to the table and have them be valued.
Many of us, when we think of discovering stories of people of color who became significant mathematicians, think of the movie Hidden Figures, which one of your visiting scholar lectures is actually about. Or more specifically, you talk about how there were many, if you will, hidden figures who helped Katherine Johnson become a research mathematician in a highly racially segregated era. What are some of the stories that you tell in that lecture, and what kind of response have you gotten from the students and others in attendance?
When I went to Howard University this past fall and gave a presentation on the mathematics of the hidden figures, and I talked about her research mentor, William Clater. He earned his bachelor's degree at Howard, and he was actually a part of their inaugural master's class there as well. He was the third Black to earn a PhD in mathematics. When you get a PhD, you have this dissertation, which is a paper that basically shows your research contribution to the field. Now, when people came across Clater's dissertation, it was groundbreaking. It was amazing. And to be frank, some people read people's dissertations, but most of them are kind of, it's the start. But this one was great. So that's a pretty unique experience. The problem was, when people found out who he was, what race he was, it was pushed aside. And so Katherine Johnson's research mentor was at West Virginia and trained her to be the research mathematician that she became. She took all of the math courses there, exhausted them. And even though Clater, who was her math professor, his career had so many obstacles and barriers because he wanted to do the research itself, he at least, I think, was an honor to give and instill in other students, including Katherine Johnson, to go on and do this mathematics. And when I told the story of William Clater when I was at Howard, you can imagine this young guy, curly hair, kind of bronze skin, driving through campus in a convertible. He liked to play tennis. And he also flew an airplane, and he would fly it so close that one of the wheels nicked the president's place there. So he was a flashy guy at the start. But when you look at William Clater's career over time and how many times he got told no, because of the race, because he was Black, and he couldn't get to the into the mathematics meetings. He couldn't stay at some of the R1 research institutions. He couldn't get into the peer networks in mathematics where research is really being cultivated. It really did, I think, have a negative impact. And I'm hoping somebody does a movie on him. Maybe I'll do a call for Spike Lee to do a movie on William Clater, just to show how the circle sometimes can really prevent somebody from going through it and really making the contributions.
Shocking in so many ways, and of course, not completely behind us either. But one would have thought, one would have liked to have thought, that particularly a field like mathematics, the work would stand on its own. It's not normative in the way that sociology might be, or even political science, if it's not empirical political science. So you would think that the work would simply stand on its own. And yet, as you say, the work does stand on its own until the author's race is revealed, and then other factors play a terribly destructive and debilitating role.
Exactly.
You are the inaugural director of the Atlanta University Center Data Science Initiative. Can you tell us a little bit about the initiative and its work, and how have you been able to use this position as the inaugural director to help build this institution?
So the Atlanta University Center presidents, that's President David Thomas of Morehouse College, President Valerie Montgomery Rice of Morehouse School of Medicine, and President Helen Gale of Spelman College, and President George French of Clark Atlanta University, came together and had a vision to expand data science, not just in the Atlanta University Center schools, but across all historically Black colleges and universities, really to address the underrepresentation of minorities with credentials in data science and data analytics, and to advance, and also to advance research in focusing on empowering it for all communities. And so United Health Group funded the initiative back in 2019 to launch it. And then I came in August of 2020. So day one was, okay, figure out how to do data science across the four HBCUs here in Atlanta. Day two was, now do it across 100 some odd historically Black colleges and universities nationally. And I was like, okay, how am I supposed to do that? Where's the roadmap? They would say, well, that's why we hired you. Okay. So as any good researcher would do, I gathered all the data I could in that first semester, either through interviews, presentations, documents, everything, and just did a cluster analysis around emerging themes and things that the Atlanta University Center wanted. And so then we came and we arrived at two goals, developing talent and creating new knowledge. And we've launched different programs from workshops to a mini grant program to work groups, a data science club, new courses, including data in the African diaspora, academic programs, just really been having a great time just pushing the academics and then also pushing the research. We're working with a group of social work faculty at Clark Atlanta who are bringing data-driven insights for the social work practitioner. And data science is one of those fields that works across all disciplines, which means I get to hang out with everybody with the aim of bringing something of value and some insights that data can afford.
Everybody, I think, has a strong reaction to math going back to primary school. There are those who love it in and of itself. There are those who ultimately find it's productive for other things they wish to do with mathematical analysis. And then there are some people who are just straight up quantitative phobic. They resist math as a discipline or as an approach. Now, people who've been with us listening to this conversation obviously are in the first two categories, maybe even some in the third category who thought they'd give it another try. So I wonder if you could help us build the curriculum, build the book list for some of our listeners. What are a couple of suggestions you might have for people who have some background in the field of mathematical analysis, but there's something new and noteworthy that they might do well to give some consideration to and read? And for those without much background in the field, as a good port of entry in some of the things that you've been interested in the field of mathematics and applied mathematics.
One of the books that I think is really neat, it's by W.B. Du Bois. It's called Data Portraits, Visualing Black America. And so Du Bois was a professor in Atlanta University back in the day who created all of these visual portraits, these data visualizations without a computer, I might add, to talk about Black America, to say what's happening, what's not happening. And they're very colorful. They're very accurate. And people ask me, does data science, do you need a computer to do it? He created this whole, I don't know how he did it, but he created this whole book of data visualizations that are highly accurate without a computer by hand. And it really was a monumental, I think, an important feat in data visualizations and how we can think about data to tell a story and to also ignite curiosity and maybe change in a deeper understanding of what's going on. So if I had to say, if there's one book, it is on Amazon, I think Kindle too, W.B. Du Bois's Data Portraits book, Visualizing Black America.
We think of him for such monumental works of American sociology as the soul of Black folk, somewhat less well-known but equally provocative soul of white folk. This is another one to add to our Du Bois list. So thank you for bringing that one to our attention. And I'm going to put it on my list. When I think of the challenge put before you as a first-year student at Spelman, it seems as if two major challenges are put in front of you. What graduate degree are you going to pursue and how are you going to change the world? And you have managed to do both. You got that graduate degree and you have continued through your scholarship, but also your work in education policy and accessibility of higher education in the applied sciences field to people of color to have continued to change the world. Thank you for those contributions, for joining us this year as a Phi Beta Kappa visiting scholar, and for sitting down today with me on Key Conversations with Phi Beta Kappa.
Thanks for having me.
This podcast is produced by Phantom Center Media and Entertainment. Kojin Toshiro is lead producer and mixed this episode. Michelle Baker is editor and co-producer. And Hadley Kelly is the Phi Beta Kappa producer on the show. Our theme song is Back to Back by Jan Perchik. To learn more about the work of the Phi Beta Kappa Society and our visiting scholar program, please visit pbk.org. Thanks for listening. I'm Fred Lawrence. Until next time.